Imagine, you're a 16th century Spanish soldier, right? Landing in the New World. You encounter people who, well, they don't speak your language or share your faith.
Right, they aren't part of your kingdom at all.
Exactly. So in that moment, what actually stops you from treating them like animals? I mean, for centuries, the West has wrestled with this, trying to build restraints for the most unrestrained thing humans do, which is go to war.
Yeah, it's a massive question.
It really is. So today, our exploration into the source material is taking us through James Turner Johnson's Just War tradition and the restraint of war, basically to see how we moved from, kill everyone who's different to these complex rules we have now.
And it's an exploration of how we try to balance two conflicting pillars. You have jus ad bellum, which is the legal and moral why behind starting a fight.
Right, the justification.
Exactly. And then there's jus in bello, the rules for how you fight once the bullets actually start flying. And what's fascinating is that these rules didn't come from pacifists. They often came from the warriors themselves.
Yeah, because if we look back at the Middle Ages, the rules of the game weren't really written for civilians. The source mentions this blurring of bellum, like public war, and duellum, which were private duels.
Yeah, the private disputes.
Right. So it sounds like the first laws of war were basically like a country club agreement for knights.
That's a really sharp way to see it, honestly. It was the law of arms. I mean, think of the knightly class as a professional fraternity.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they owed each other courtesy and fair play because they shared a social status. They weren't trying to save the world, they were protecting their brand, essentially.
So you wouldn't kill a captured knight because you'd want that same mercy.
Exactly. This chivalry is actually the direct, albeit very messy, ancestor of modern non-combatant immunity.
So the first rules of war were just the ultimate jocks of history, making sure their professional matches didn't turn into street brawls.
Pretty much, yeah.
But that only works if everyone in the club shares the same religion and values, right? What happens when that bubble bursts?
Well, that's where the 16th century shift to natural law becomes so critical. When the Spanish encountered the Indians in the New World, the old divine law framework started to collapse.
Because that was the idea that you only have rights if you're a Christian.
Right, exactly. So a thinker named Francisco de Victoria stepped in with this radical aha moment. He argued that human rights don't come from your baptism, they come from your ability to reason.
That feels like the first real bridge language, Like he was essentially saying, even if we don't share a God, we share a brain.
That is perfectly put. He used natural law as a mechanism to argue that a difference of religion is not a cause of just war.
Which is a huge secular shift.
It really was a move towards secularizing restraint, shifting the logic from, I can kill you because you're a heathen, to I have to respect you because you have the same capacity for reason.
Right, but then the Industrial Revolution hits. And suddenly, that gentlemanly reason feels pretty flimsy. We're moving from swords to mass-produced rifles and railroads. How did the cage change when war became a factory process?
Well, it had to become a formal contract. You look at the American Civil War, and things were getting incredibly ugly. To stop the chaos, we got the Liber Code, which is General Orders number 100.
Wait, so it wasn't just a list of do's and don'ts?
No, it functioned as a reciprocal contract. The way it worked was simple. If I treat your rebels like legitimate soldiers with rights, you have to do the same for mine.
Okay, I see.
Yeah, if we both agree the other side isn't just a criminal to be executed, we might actually survive the peace afterward.
I do have to push back there, though. I mean, we're just conveying the source material here, but that reciprocity sounds great on paper. Look at modern guerrilla warfare, though.
Oh, sure.
If you grant war rights to insurgents who intentionally hide among civilians, aren't you actually rewarding them for putting civilians in harm's way? Doesn't the humanitarian rule make the battlefield more dangerous for the innocent?
That is the deepest tension in the tradition. On one side, you have thinkers like Paul Ramsey, who argue that discrimination, like the absolute duty to protect non-combatants, is non-negotiable.
Even if it makes winning harder.
Right. But then on the other side, you have the reality of military necessity. Johnson shows how even modern thinkers admit that in a supreme emergency, like stopping a genocide, those rules get stretched to the breaking point.
So it's a constant, painful calculation of how much evil you can permit to stop a greater one.
Exactly.
So to wrap this up, we've gone from religious mandates to knightly courtesy to a politico-moral doctrine of relative justice. We aren't looking for a perfectly just war anymore. We're just trying to keep the violence proportional.
Yeah, it's about making moral decisions in the gray areas. The tradition teaches us the enemy isn't a monster. They are a legal and moral peer.
That is a really heavy thought to sit with. And here's a final provocative one for you listening. If just war is really about making relative moral decisions in a world of shadows, does searching for a perfectly just cause actually make us more dangerous?
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, like, does believing your side is 100% righteous make you feel like the rules no longer apply? Just something to think about the next time you see a conflict framed as pure good versus pure evil.